Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. This series, we're asking our guests to address some big questions. And today's question asks whether we would be better served if there was a world government. Our two guests are extremely well placed to address this question, and in the order you will meet them, they are Dr. Lou Cabrera, who's an Associate Professor in the Griffith Business School, to whom we're grateful for tonight's venue, which makes him our host this evening. Thank you, Lou. Lou gained his PhD in political science from the University of Washington in 2001 after an earlier career as a staff reporter with the Associated Press in the USA. Knows all there is to know about fake news. He's taught at Arizona State University, the University of Birmingham in the UK. He joined Griffith University in 2014 and has written widely on issues of global justice, global citizenship, and on ethical issues arising around migration and economic integration between states. He also serves as the co-convener of the World Government Research Network. Our other guest is Dr. Mark Beeson, who's Professor of International Politics at the University of Western Australia. Before joining UWA at the beginning of 2015, he was a Professor of International Relations at Murdoch. Previously, he taught here at Griffith and also at York and Birmingham, where he met Lou, in the United Kingdom. He's co-editor of Contemporary Politics and the founding editor of Critical Studies of the Asia Pacific. Mark is also the author of Is World Government the Only Hope?, which was published in The Conversation. For those who don't know The Conversation, a terrific website, in 2015. After Lou and Mark have spoken, we'll welcome your contribution to the discussion. So, Lou, will you kick off our discussion on whether global governance is a good idea or not?
Yes, thanks very much, Charles. And thank you for coming tonight. So the title of the talk is Global Justice and Global Government. As Charles mentioned, I'm co-convener of the World Government Research Network, which you can see at www.wgresearch.org. I'll start with the central point of the talk, and that's, it may be a surprising one, world government is not ultimately the point. That is the point of the talk. The core questions, I think, anytime we're talking about political institutions are, what is the function of those political institutions? In other words, what's the moral purpose of the political institutions? What are they intended to do? What purpose do they serve? Based on that function, we then ask, what would be the purpose of global institutions? Form will always follow function. Institutional form will always follow function. Once we have the answer to those questions, we'll know how much, quote unquote, world government we need, if any, and how we might support its development, if indeed we should support its development. It's possible that depending on how we answer those questions about the function of political institutions, a system of sovereign states will be the ideal rather than some world government. I'll offer reasons to think that's not the case, but it certainly remains a possibility, and I think Professor Beeson will speak to that possibility tonight. Okay, the outline of the talk. I'll offer brief historical background on world government with emphasis on when it was actually a popular idea. And then I will look at three proposed world government functions or purposes: security, democracy, and justice, with emphasis on justice. And I'll close by talking about global citizenship to promote global justice and, quote, more world government. So the world government heyday lasted from about 1945 to 1950. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the spur, the bombs that were dropped on those two Japanese cities, obliterating them and making the world realize in an instant that the world could end in a virtual instant if things kept on the way they were. So there's a photo of what is now the museum in Hiroshima. That's the A-bomb dome there at the top, which has been preserved in that museum as the centerpiece of it, just to show people what the bomb looked like. And you can see utter devastation all around it in quite a wide radius. The heyday in the US, the UK, and Europe You saw leading intellectuals, political figures, advocating world government to prevent world's end. They were very explicit about that. Here's a quote from Albert Einstein saying, as a citizen of Germany, I saw how excessive nationalism can spread like a disease, bringing tragedy to millions. To combat the disease, we have to eliminate nationalistic sentiments, first by instituting an international government with sovereignty over individual states. He was very serious about that. He suspended his own scientific work for about 18 months to campaign for such an institutional end. And I'll talk about his underlying moral purpose in a moment. Hundreds of thousands joined civil society movements all around the world. You even saw Congress in the United States take 2 days in both houses for to consider bills for world government, to convert the new United Nations into a world government. In Australia, you saw Bert Evatt, who headed Australia's UN delegation, became president of the UN General Assembly in 1948, put forward a very serious proposal from the Australian government for a World Court of Human Rights. It would have interpreted rights specified in the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It did not gain broad support, though, and was knocked off by the outbreak of the Cold War just a few years later. In fact, that ended very quickly the heyday of the world government ideal. With the onset of the Cold War, we saw world government advocacy painted as support for presumed Soviet global domination plans. That just wasn't something that most people wanted to be associated with. And the idea was very quickly pushed to the fringes, where it stayed for decades. In the early 1990s, with the end of the Cold War, you saw renewed interest in that world government ideal among academics. So growing global economic integration revived interest in full global integration among scholars. They looked at the rise of the World Trade Organization in the mid-1990s. The European Union in 1992-93 started taking real strides toward becoming a serious political union. You saw competitive globalization, where in order to compete with rising powers such as China, in order to compete with the European Union, regions such as North America began taking steps towards serious economic integration in the mid-1990s. The nuclear threat continued to be very real. That motivated some authors to say that we're not taking it seriously enough. For a backgrounder on that, if you Google Cabrera Aeon, you'll see A-E-O-N, you'll see a general circulation article that I wrote on the rise of world government, the interest among academics. So there are three, again, purposes in this academic literature. The first one is security. So world government, government in general, the primary purpose of government is security, to secure individuals against deadly threats. In the heyday period, you saw security foregrounded, so Einstein and many others argued that global institutions, very strong global institutions, are needed to control nuclear weapons and warfare more generally, the scourge of warfare. The prescribed form following that function was a very powerful world state. In 2007, in a book that got a lot of attention, won in fact the two major awards in political science and international relations, Daniel Dewdney argued that there are two purposes that government serves. One is to protect us from anarchy, from the chaos that can accompany a lack of government, either at the domestic level, strong state institutions, or at the global level where anarchy continues to pose a constant threat of warfare, but also hierarchy. The threat is not only from anarchy, but concentrated hierarchy, oppressive government. He said the last thing we want is a very powerful world state, because that could simply be a prescription for oppression. What we want is a very limited global agency controlling a portion of nuclear codes. But he's not at all an optimist. He says that's what we need to actually secure us from the nuclear threat, but he believes it wouldn't be possible to actually get states to agree to that until we're all scared enough by a limited nuclear war. You know, he doesn't say this, but we might imagine India and Pakistan, something like this, to remind us of the global nuclear threat. He thinks that's when that kind of agency would be possible. So not a very optimistic view. Function two would be democracy. The idea here is that as human beings, we have a right to autonomy, to individual freedom. And that right is not respected. That's our core right. It's not respected when we're denied a democratic say. We should be enabled to have a say in those decisions which deeply affect our lives. In the age of globalization, many more of those decisions are being taken beyond the nation state. So runs this line of argument. And we need to recapture democratic autonomy. We need to recapture the democratic say for people within states by creating democratic institutions beyond states. So the ultimate form would be some form of binding world government, but with fluid jurisdictions based on affected interests. So there would actually, according to some proposals, there would be a court set up to determine just who should have a say in which decisions. And you can see here a photo. It's a large-scale protest against the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, the kind of protest that usually focuses on a lack of input, a lack of transparency in the decision-making process that goes into these kinds of treaties, and then the governance that flows from these treaties. So form would follow function here. The function is enabling a democratic say. That's what political institutions are for, enabling people to be free by having a say in the decisions which affect their lives. The form would be some kind of world government, some kind of global democracy, but a fairly limited one in most arguments. It wouldn't be tasked with protecting human rights in a comprehensive way. It would simply be about enabling us to have a democratic say and enabling a democratic majority to decide on decisions, to have input. So a closely related proposal, and a very serious one, is the campaign for a UN Parliamentary Assembly. This would create a second chamber alongside the UN General Assembly. Sorry, I've lost this. And it would be consultative at first. It would be advisory. So our nation states would send elected representatives, people already in Congress, already in Parliament, and they would offer input. They would try to exercise some oversight over the business of the UN. It would be expected to grow in oversight and policymaking powers over time. And it's actually, as I said, a serious proposal. More than 1,400 current and former parliamentarians have endorsed it. They've got some very high-level endorsements from political leaders. And it's a going campaign that seems to be gaining in momentum. Whether it will actually succeed is another question, but certainly it's something to watch. And finally, the one I want to support, the function that I want to propose is the right one to support, would be justice. And here we would promote global justice, usually translated as human rights. So economic, civil, and political rights. We can think of the rights that are enshrined in the major UN human rights treaties. So why would we need to focus on rights? Well, let's think of economic rights. It's a fact that around 1.5 billion people still lack access to adequate food, shelter, education, health care, other bare necessities. Another 900 million are one setback away from this, one health care issue, one lost job, and they'll fall into this category. 70% of the people in the world still live on the equivalent of less than US $10 per day. So less than $10 per day equivalent. So trying to live on $10 in the United States, which is not very much money. Only about 10% of the people in the world make more than $20,000 per year. Okay. The core claim for a justice world government forum would be that human rights are unlikely to be fully realized in a world of competitive sovereign states. So it prescribes, as a form, gradual global political integration as a means of promoting and protecting the vital interests of ever more persons in common. It's very much an incrementalist approach. Why political integration? Why shouldn't we think that we can also achieve this in a world of competitive sovereign states, very much like the one we have now? What I focused on in my work are biases, which naturally arise in a sovereign state system. They promote an us and them mentality, which means that interests are not protected and promoted in common, which means that inequality and the underfulfillment of human rights is pretty much our destiny if we choose that sort of system. So what are some of these biases? Well, the first one is simple collective self-interest. We simply do have an interest in promoting our own interests as a domestic population. The second one is more complex and perhaps more interesting, fiduciary duties. Under the rules of the game, if you look at the UN Charter, if you look at doctrines based on that, such as responsibility to protect, leaders are understood to have a clear duty to protect and promote the interests of their own citizens, first and primarily, strongly primarily. In some of the rhetoric of Donald Trump, we've seen at one end of the continuum that kind of approach expressed. He foregrounds these duties, makes them absolute. So in his inaugural, he said, from this day forward, it's going to be only America first, America first. Every decision on trade, taxes, immigration, foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. Usually you don't hear leaders saying it that boldly or that firmly, but he's expressing a fiduciary duty idea that's very much a part of our current global system. It's in the fabric of it. Another subtle bias is electoral bias. Leaders simply do have a powerful self-interest-based incentive to give more weight to the needs and interests of their own constituents, especially in the global context. So here we've got Malcolm Turnbull in his earlier days with on a sign which says, putting Wentworth first, that's his constituency. Of course, when he gets to Parliament, he's expected to also consider the broader interests of Australia, of all Australians. He's not expected to rule, to help govern in the interests of the world primarily or strongly. And that's, again, the way the system is structured. There's not a strong incentive to do that. Now that he's prime minister, it's very difficult to get elected on a platform of I will take care of people in other countries if you elect me. It's simply not the way politics works. It's not the way the system is structured. And finally, an even more subtle bias, but I think the most important one, and one that's very prominent in social contract theory, in fact, often given as the reason why we need a state in the first place, why we need political institutions. States are the final judges in their own cases about moral obligations in the current system. In the same way that individuals before the state are said to be the final judge in their own case about moral obligations, about right and wrong. The global system lacks a neutral judge and strong compliance capacity. If you look back at the social contract tradition from Hobbes to Locke to Madison, many other authors, what they all would say is that having individuals who are the judge in their own case about right and wrong, about conflict, about what they're allowed to do, always leads to conflict between those individuals. You need a neutral judge. You need to create the state if you don't have one. If you have a weak state, you need to create a stronger state. The global system lacks that neutral judge. There is no entity able to tell states what you're doing there is not appropriate according to the rules to which you bound yourself. Now, there's a judge who can tell states that. The UN human rights regime has many bodies. It lacks strong compliance capacity. All right, we don't need to think of a global army, but we can think of even something like the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights, which has grown up with it, which might be a partial model for such a neutral judge. The European Court of Human Rights is able to issue judgments that are treated as binding by states because there's a lot at stake for them to comply within the European Union to continue receiving the benefits of that union. Okay, a global government, is that the appropriate end then? Well, a fully integrated global political system would be the preferred form if, in boldface and italics, it best promoted rights. Form follows function again. If a very powerful world state could put rights at risk more than promote them, it shouldn't be advocated. In fact, I think there are a lot of reasons to reject the idea, the Einstein-type idea of a very powerful world state controlling a lot of offensive military machinery. There are reasons to promote deep global integration and some balancing of more policing, peacekeeping-type forces as the long-term end, as the aim toward which we should be working. Now, is that aim achievable? Well, this approach doesn't pin all its hopes on the near-term feasibility of full global government, or even, in fact, on the long-term feasibility. We can aim for, quote, more world government, end quote, to address the biases and promote more rights fulfillment. Again, form follows function. The function we're after is promoting rights protections for individuals as and where possible. I think more world government, more regional government is a way to do that. And even if China and Russia never get on board, we can still make a lot of progress. That would be the argument here. Okay, what might we do then? And here's where global citizenship comes in. We can strive to act like global citizens. We don't have a global government. It's not possible to be a global citizen yet. But what we can do is assume some duties which would help promote rights protection. So we can make direct contributions of time, energy, and resources. www.givewell.org is a place to look for contributions to be able to make, effective ones. We can engage in domestic advocacy, supporting more open and accountable immigration and asylum policies and integration rights. Those are rights across borders for individuals. We can engage in interstate advocacy duties, pressing our governments to meet appropriately robust goals for international aid, that 0.07 of GDP that the UN has been pressing for 40 years that governments have said they'll try to reach. Fair terms of trade, rights respecting foreign policy in general. Australia has actually been a leader at various times in rights respecting foreign policy, in dedicating itself to that, at least rhetorically. Superstate advocacy duties become more important here. We can support regional integration and regional development and democratization efforts. European Union is where this is very important, especially in this age of Brexit, but also the African Union. It's got some very ambitious goals. CARICOM in the Caribbean, Mercosur in Latin America, to a certain extent ASEAN, a less ambitious project, but certainly one that has created opportunities for pressing human rights, the ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights and some other groups. We can support accountability efforts targeting the WTO, the International Monetary Fund, other global governance bodies, and we can support the campaign for UN Parliamentary Assembly. So the guiding question then would be for us as global citizens, what sort of global system would best promote and protect individual rights? The guiding principle would be that we attempt to support rights protections as and where possible, especially through reform of existing political institutions and the development of new ones at the regional and global levels. What about feasibility? Well, again, a global system which actually would protect and promote the rights of all persons in the world may not be achievable even in the very long term. It's possible, again, that China, Russia, some other countries never get on board, never democratize. And I do take a very long term. I think in terms of 100 years, 200, 300, 800 years. The world's going to be around a long time. The Westphalian system is 400 years old. It's made some progress. It could be time for a next step. Such an institutional aim gives us crucial guidance for the kinds of reforms we can support in the near term. Thinking about the long-term aim, what a system would look like which actually would protect and promote the rights of all persons, gives us an idea of how what we can do in the near term. So maybe we can't get to world government, but we can get to a decent regional government in the African Union with good support from the outside, in the European Union with good press back against Brexit, against the disintegrating tendencies that arise every few decades. Is it too optimistic? Well, social struggle takes time, and it takes a lot of effort. I think it's worth reminding ourselves, voting rights for women took 80 years in many of our leading democracies. In the United States, civil rights, 150 years and counting, they're not fully secure yet. So comprehensive individual rights for all persons in the world, there's a long struggle indeed. But our engagement matters, as do the signals we send to our elected representatives about the shape we want our foreign policy, our ongoing globalization, and global institutions to take. So here's a picture of a person holding up a sign in the United States saying, immigrants are welcome here. It could go one of two ways. It could go toward far more restrictive immigration and asylum policies in the US and around the world, or there can be pushback and more open, more liberal policies can at least remain a possibility, if not a practicality in many places. To a large extent, it's up to the signals that people are willing to send. So finally, to conclude, the overarching aim is promoting rights fulfillment in the global system. Given the biases which naturally arise in that system, deep regional and ultimately global political integration very likely will be required. As individual global citizens, we can contribute directly to rights protections. We can support the creation of more world government, even if creating some full world government does not ultimately prove possible or even desirable, depending again on the form and the concentration of coercive power at the top. Thank you.
Mark, you're up.
Thank you. Thanks, Lou. Okay. Let me just give you a little idea of what I'm going to talk about. And my title is deliberate, and it reflects my somewhat ambivalent ideas about some of these things. I have to say that, to start off with, I wish that I was making Lou's argument in many ways, and it gives me no pleasure to make the kinds of arguments that I'm going to be trying to make this evening. But it's sadly, depressingly easy to make some of the arguments that I'm going to make, and I think the evidence is very much on my side, and that gives me no pleasure to say so. But one thing that I would say at the outset is that, and I don't want to personalize this debate too much, but I think it's important to think about the kinds of conclusions that we come to about some of these debates reflects the kinds of people that we are in some ways. And I'm happy to say that I think that Lou is a finer human being than I am in many ways. And I think part of the reason for that is because Lou has kids and I don't. And I think that's part of the explanation about the kinds of values and conclusions that we come to about some of these kinds of issues. And because Lou does have children, it's difficult for him and for many other parents, I think, to take a view of the world that is essentially pessimistic and drawing conclusions about the difficulties of realizing very desirable sorts of outcomes. And I wish that Lou, and I wish him the best of luck with his arguments and his optimism about the future, but I think it's very difficult to make that kind of argument in a persuasive way, no matter how normatively desirable it might be and how understandable it is for people like Lou to be wanting to make that argument in the first place. And this is this point about subjectivity and what I've described as the parental imperative. And it's difficult for people with kids to make any other kind of argument because it forecloses possibilities about their future as well. The other point to make about the advocates of world government, which is also somewhat implausible, people like Alexander Wendt, you may not know this guy, he's one of the most prominent and well-respected international relations theorists in the world today. And he's written some very influential, or some very interesting perhaps, maybe not as influential as they might be, but some very interesting papers about the possibilities for world government. And Wendt takes a sort of 200-year time frame, I think I'm right in saying, Lou. And that's kind of interesting. But as far as I'm concerned, what is the point of a framework that is couched in terms of 200 years? I mean, from a very self-interested, selfish perspective, I'm basically interested in the next 20 years or so, give or take, which is the amount of time I'm going to be around on the planet, personally. So what happens after that is interesting in theory and in principle, but as a practical issue, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't really matter in the most fundamental kind of sense. So I'm concerned about what's going to happen in the time frame that I'm going to be conscious of what's going on and might be able to have some kind of tangential influence on what's going on. That's all that really matters to me in a very self-centered way, partly because I don't have kids and I don't have that vested interest in future generations. So that kind of frames some of the kind of perspectives and things that I'm going to talk about and say something about now. But I think it's best to put that up front, I think. So, is it selfish and uncaring and heartless to make these kinds of arguments? Maybe it is, but I think as academics, that's what Lou and I do for a living, we're kind of paid to think about these kinds of things in a kind of an objective way, and I think it's possibly easier for me to be somewhat objective about this than perhaps it is for people like Lou and other people with this kind of powerful vested interest in the future. The prospects for world government, I think, have always been fairly unlikely. As Lou pointed out, they had their heyday before and after the Second World War for reasons that are well-known historical circumstances, and yet despite those really powerful drivers and imperatives and incentives to try to do something serious about world government, and despite the fact that people like H.G. Wells and Einstein, a lot of other intellectual heavyweights and luminaries lined up to argue in favor of something like world government, it's not enough. It's not enough that smart people have good ideas about what ought to be done. We have to recognize and acknowledge that lots of people don't agree, don't understand, don't think such ideas are feasible, plausible, or indeed terribly likely. And if you start talking about time frames that are beyond the foreseeable intellectual or generational horizon, I think you're really struggling to make an argument that anybody's going to take terribly seriously. When people are concerned about what's happening next week, where their jobs are coming from, what's happening with climate change in the next 10 or 20 years, those are the kinds of things that are really driving global politics at the moment, it seems to me. Not a concern about the fate of generations, three or four generations out. And it's sort of sad but true, and it gives me no pleasure to say so, but I think that's the reality that we have to take very, very seriously. Now, it seems to me that when we think about the forces that are working against the possibility of global government, there are at least four big forces in the world that are making this more difficult than possibly it's been, certainly in my lifetime perhaps, and possibly ever. So let me just kind of run through these as possible. I think I might have lost the top of my slide there, but anyway, the big point about the European Union, and let me just say and put on the record that nobody is a bigger fan of the European Union than I am, in principle, and as a possible model for the organisation of political and indeed social life across national borders. It's the best example we've ever had of the ability of people, policymakers, to put aside national differences and to collaborate and to coordinate their activities in really important and meaningful ways. We don't have a better example of this happening in human history, and so if the European project falls over, which I increasingly fear it may do, or even if it carries on, it will be a pale replica of its powers and influence in its heyday, then I think that will be a really unfortunate example for us all, because as I point out here, the significance of the European Union is what it's already done, and I think the dangers are that young people these days regard the EU with a good deal of skepticism. In Australia, young people don't know that much about it, and they regard it as synonymous with an overweening state, ineffective bureaucracy, a lot of things that are stereotypes and caricatures of what states can do at different times. They don't understand the significance of the achievements that the European Union has made because they don't recognize or understand some of the lessons of the past. And the big thing about the European Union, of course, is that it demonstrates that the most violent part of the planet, that is Western Europe, can be pacified, people can cooperate amongst themselves, they can transcend national imperatives. They've done all of that, so there's an established track record there that is very impressive. But the depressing fact at the moment, of course, is that all of those achievements are in doubt, and Britain's exit from Europe may be the beginning of an unstoppable wave of disintegration. As I say, it may carry on in some form, but I think it'll be a very diminished force in the future. And that's very, very unfortunate for advocates of world government, because this is as good as we've been so far. So the key points to think about are, do economic, political, cultural, immigration-type crises fundamentally undermine the possibilities of transnational solidarity? Is something like the European Union only possible in a very specific, limited set of geopolitical, historical circumstances that are not easy to replicate and are unlikely to be seen again, certainly in my lifetime, it seems? Is the European Union actually capable of dealing with some of the crises, the normal crises, if you like, economic crises? Let's not forget that the economic crisis in the European Union is far from resolved. Unemployment in Greece is still at something like 40%. much higher levels than the Great Depression. That so-called solidarity that existed in the European Union is still being undermined by the economic crisis, let alone black swan events like the unexpected immigration crisis that maybe the European Union should have expected but hasn't been able to deal with very, very effectively. And the great paradox, of course, as far as the European Union is concerned, it's been undermined by its very success. Everybody wants to live in the European Union because it's one of the few bastions of sanity and stability and effective economic governance that there is in the world. Who wouldn't want to live there given the chance? So it's not surprising that it's a magnet for people from all over the world who are trying to escape dreadful circumstances. Even within the European Union, we have to recognize that its achievements are underappreciated and are being undermined. The European Union has been at the forefront of trying to do something about climate change, and it's been a fairly isolated example of this, but crucially, it's been one that's extended across national borders. It's the only example we've got of really effective transnational cooperation in trying to address climate change, and if the EU unravels, if its institutions of governance are further undermined and lose legitimacy, even that example is going to fall by the wayside, and the skeptics and the cynics and the Donald Trumps will say, there you go, what's the point in striking up these kinds of agreements when they can't be supported, when nobody else is going along with them, we might as well let the coal industry rip and look after our own national interests. Schengen, the agreement on immigration to allow people to move freely across borders, is arguably one of the most important and significant political agreements in history, I think it's fair to say, and yet that is in serious danger of unraveling as we speak, because there is not any longer widespread support for that agreement in the context of uncontrolled immigration into the region. So Lou's very understandable and reasonable claims that human beings should have the right to travel where they want, people should be more willing to accept people who are suffering and in despair, all noble sentiments, but they are not politically feasible, is the big lesson coming out of Europe, sadly. So that's a really big problem that we need to think about and take seriously. And as I say, the problem about the end of the EU is that it's our best and arguably only example of its type, of this kind of transnational cooperation. If it falls over, it's hard to know where we're going to look for inspiration. So that's one big set of problems. The other one Lou touched on, and this is the idea that it seems incredible to think that 20 years or so ago people were talking seriously about the end of history and the spread of liberal democracy and the possibility that there was only one model of progress in the world, and that was the kind of Western liberal capitalist model. That looks like a lot of wishful thinking in retrospect. The reality is there are some very powerful countries emerging in the world today. I've listed some of them: China, Russia, Turkey. These countries are not interested in liberal democracy. They're not interested in Western values. They are interested in protecting sovereignty and maintaining authoritarian rule, increasingly so in places like Turkey, where we're seeing significant democratic rollback in a way that people wouldn't have expected 10 or 20 years or so ago. Even in countries like Australia and other Western countries, young people are not necessarily won over to the wonders of democracy. They associate it with political inefficiency, with corrupt political classes, with excessively powerful, ineffective bureaucracies. And so they're cynical about the entire political process that we associate with democracy. In those circumstances, if the rising generation is not keen and won over to democracy, it doesn't bode well for even bigger, even more implausible claims about the way that transnational politics might be argued. And I think this loss of confidence in existing institutions and loss of confidence about the future is one of the most difficult problems for advocates of world government to overcome. Because if young people in particular, and people who've lost their jobs, who are cynical about politics more generally, if they have no sense of progress and about the possibility of actually improving things in the current circumstances, then I think the prospects for world government are not only likely to be put off, but they may prove to be unrealizable in the current environment. So these kind of rising powers are definitely problems as far as this attempts to achieve world government are concerned. Any kind of progress towards world government will need to build on existing institutions, and this is the third big point. So the difficulties facing multilateral institutions at the moment are also potentially major obstacles to realizing the kinds of vision of a more institutionalized, more transnational, international order. The reality is that post-war international order that has shaped everybody's lives in the world today to a great extent is not highly valued, has been subject to scathing criticisms, is not necessarily supported by some of the rising powers in the world, and some of those key institutions themselves, like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, those key pieces of institutional architecture which have imparted some degree of stability and predictability on the international system, they are not widely supported. They have lost a good deal of authority and legitimacy in many people's eyes. They are associated with a fairly narrow set of vested interests associated with the United States in particular. And so they don't have that kind of widespread authority that might serve as a kind of precursor to a more widespread form of world governance. The key exemplar of the failure of putative world institutions is the United Nations, of course. And again, I'm a big admirer of the United Nations in principle, but in reality, it's associated with ineffectiveness, underperformance, an inability to be able to overcome powerful sectional interests, particularly on the Security Council, where the great powers routinely veto each other's initiatives because they seem to be serving narrow sectional interests. So the UN hasn't been able to realize some of its big and important and noble goals because of these vested national interests. So the United Nations is hostage to the interests of the great powers. It is underfunded. It is overburdened with expectations and the sorts of things that people would like to the UN to be able to do, despite the fact that it doesn't get universal support or assistance in actually trying to do them. So unfortunately, and it gives me no pleasure to say this whatsoever, but I think the United Nations is another good example of a well-intentioned organization that is divided by differences of opinion about what it should be doing, about fundamental reluctance to cooperate in a meaningful manner, particularly where that's going to impinge on the domestic sovereignty of individual national governments, because there is absolutely no enthusiasm for that at all outside of the European Union. And even within the European Union now, I think we're seeing increasing pushback against the idea of pooling sovereignty, which was the essential precondition for the effective cooperation that actually happened under the European Union. So if it's happening in the European Union with the likes of Britain and maybe France next week, if it's happening there, any expectation of it happening in authoritarian regimes like China and Russia, maybe even Brazil, some of the biggest and most important countries in the world, even India, maybe a democracy, but Modi, I think, is a potential charismatic, possibly authoritarian leader who may be no more enthusiastic about really cooperating with his neighbours than some of his neighbours are. So sadly, these kinds of zero-sum views of the world in which another country's gain is your loss may become more prevalent, may become more difficult to shift, and are fundamental obstacles to international cooperation of a serious nature, it seems to me. So let me talk about my final obstacle to possible world government and international cooperation, and that is the, I think, very unfortunate election of Donald Trump. My guess is, for what it's worth, that even Donald Trump didn't expect to be elected and to have to deal with some of the kinds of problems and issues that he is dealing with. But I think, given America's historical place in the world, given the fact that America sees itself as embodying a set of values that are associated with freedom and liberty and very noble and well-intentioned ideas, and given the fact that Trump clearly doesn't have any real understanding or indeed sympathy for those kinds of virtues and ideals, and is certainly not the embodiment of them, then I think that's a real worry for the world generally, because for better or worse, intentionally or unintentionally, the United States still does provide a form of leadership, whether it's conscious or unconscious, and it does have an ability to really influence the way that important issues are decided and acted upon, or indeed not acted upon in the case of things like climate change. So the fact that Trump is hostile to multilateral institutions, doesn't see the value of them, doesn't recognize their value to the United States that created many of those institutions, is a really fundamental and unfortunate possibility as far as the United Nations and the United States and the rest of the world are concerned. So this approach to international politics that Trump's enunciated, this transactional politics, doing deals of a business-like nature as a way of conducting foreign policy, I think that there's no possibility of us collectively, as citizens of the world, pursuing the idea of the collective good when, as Lou's presentation pointed out, Trump's mantra is America first, America first, and he's not interested in doing anything directly that directly contributes to a notion of the kind of collective good that affects all people of the world. As I mentioned, I don't think he has any really good understanding of the historical context within which American hegemony operates, or the benefits that have accrued to the United States and the world more generally from the kind of institutions that they've developed in the post-war period. Now, optimists think that Trump will be socialized into better behavior, both internationally and domestically, by the institutions of the international system to a lesser extent, but primarily by the institutions that exist in the United States itself, the congressional system, the checks and balances that are allegedly part of the American system. Now, we may all hope that that is indeed the case, but the track record so far doesn't suggest that we can necessarily have too much confidence in that possibility. He's already rammed through his first nomination for the Supreme Court, which is a very, very powerful body in the United States, and he's done so by changing established precedents for the election of Supreme Court judges in a way that people have found surprising and alarming. If he's willing to do that in that particular area with the support of his overwhelming command of both houses of Congress, then I think it's questionable who's socializing who. Is Trump going to have a bigger impact on the institutions of American government than American government is going to have on Donald Trump? And that's the jury, as they say, is still out on that one. But I think what we can say is that Trump's behavior and his attitude so far suggests that the famous rules-based international order that people talk about in this country as being a reason for supporting the alliance and American foreign policy more generally, I think we have to say that there's a big question mark at the very least about that institutional order, and that is the best hope we have so far for achieving some kind of stepping stone towards the sort of transnational order that Lou's described earlier on. So, by way of conclusion, as I say, it's a pity, in my view, that Lou's not right, but unfortunately, I don't think he is. I think there's a lot to be said at a normative, intellectual level in favour of world government. I have to say, if it could be realised, I would be one of the first people to sign up for it. But my job, I think, tonight was to raise some of the problems and the counter-arguments that can be mounted against this, and to highlight why it still remains a very, very difficult project. Certainly, I've got absolutely no confidence I'm going to see it in my lifetime. But I think the big question is, are these kinds of projects only possible in specific historical circumstances, and they have to be fairly supportive sorts of circumstances as well? The sorts of circumstances that underpin the emergence of the European Union as a highly institutionalized, very powerful entity that was able to reshape European politics. So it's a very challenging set of circumstances, and I simply don't think that they exist at the moment. And the ability of some of the existing organizations that we have in front of us, like the United Nations, remind us, I think, unfortunately, that some of the big problems that are emerging in the world today, and I think for my money, climate change is still the most formidable and the most important of these challenges. It's a powerful reminder, I think, that our existing array of institutions simply doesn't have the capacity at this stage, and possibly never, to address some of these institutions, some of these problems in a meaningful sort of way, particularly when the most powerful country in the world is led by somebody who clearly is highly skeptical about the possibility and the usefulness of actually trying to address some of these kinds of issues. So unfortunately, and it, as I say, it gives me absolutely no pleasure to say this, I think that the array of problems that are out there at the moment is beyond the remit of the kind of institutions we have at the moment, some of which are being undermined, and under those circumstances it's very difficult to be confident about the realization of world government in the foreseeable future.